This is Fintan Dunn, and you're very welcome. This is Truth Radio. And you are on the next level. It's Wednesday the 8th of February and you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us. Thanks also to our sponsor neemwell.com, your personal source for potent Indian neem. It's an extraordinary Indian herb, antiviral, antifungal, anti-inflammatory, antihistamine, natural, and the talented and gifted Kathy McMahon formulates that in a hypoallergenic base. Find out more at neemwell.com, neemwell.com. Now, we'll be speaking in this edition of The Next Level to, well, the best weatherman in the world, the ultimate weatherman. That's Ken Ring of predictweather.com. And not only does he produce the most incredible detailed weather forecasts for his native New Zealand, but also long-range forecasts for around the world. Long-range forecasts, you said, they can't even predict what's happening next week. Well, you're right, but Ken Ring is no ordinary weatherman. He's imbued with ancient knowledge, and he's going to share some of that with us, as well as also his opinions on the current scares about global warming, ozone depletion, and more. Now, Ken has appeared on radio around the world, and he has impressed them with his weather forecasting. How does he do it? We'll find out as we speak to the man who has got more knowledge than all the monkey-suited television weathermen in the world added together. He's joining us on the line right now from New Zealand. Ken Ring, you're very, very welcome to The Next Level.
Thank you, Fintan. It's my pleasure.
Okay, well, we are so glad to have you on because I think you're the ultimate weatherman. That's my estimate.
Yeah, people call me the man on the moon. I guess that time. All I'm really doing is bringing some very old methods and traditional sort of practices to the fore again, which is a little bit unknown in Western society, but it's not in Eastern societies. And when you consider that 90% of the world still have a lunar calendar, where the calendar begins, each month begins with the day of the new moon, and ends the day before the next new moon, and they've done this to retain some kind of handle on weather forecasting, because the lunar calendar will give you the days when it's going to rain, and these societies have monsoons. The word monsoon comes from the word moon, and what they've done is they've retained something that's going to tell them almost to the day when the monsoon is coming. So you're looking at about 90% of the world still. You're looking at Indonesians, Malayans, Indians, Chinese, the older Japanese societies, the Semitics, the Africans, most indigenous tribes, and you know, that leaves about 10% of the world who are Western and Christian who've moved away from this. And they've actually moved away from it for religious reasons, because 2,000 years ago, the early Christian edict was that only God was supposed to know what was going to happen, and anybody who predicted anything was, from now on, to be called a heathen and to be cast out. And that's what science was. It was a method of predicting things. Anybody who published a map, they were a heathen, so they went around burning the libraries that had the maps in them, and especially Alexandria. And anybody who was a healer, they couldn't tell somebody they were going to get better. And these happened to be the women. So it became a gender war, which really continued for, well, right up to this day.
Well, we even have the phrase, a loony or a lunatic. But they're missing out the fact that the moon is the most influential celestial body on the Earth. It has some very sophisticated orbits. Maybe you could just outline what those are and the kind of effects they can have.
Yeah, sure. There's about 12 cycles that I use in the course of my weather forecasting. And there is that phase one that's about 29 days. Then there's one where the moon speeds up and slows down. That's on a 27-day circuit. And it speeds up and slows down as it comes closer towards us and further away again. So there's a change in distance throughout 27 days and a change in speed accordingly, because it sort of zooms in and then slowly goes away and then zooms back in, because it's an elliptical orbit. And that's a very strong one. because whenever it comes closer to the Earth, it whips up winds, whips up more turbulence. 1 minute, it's above the equator. It hits about 28 degrees above the equator at the moment. That's its furthest point north. It just hit that today, which is, you know, the 8th of March. And after today, it's going to start to slowly drift down towards the equator, across the equator, and about 14 days' time, it'll sit at the most southern point in the Bennett circuit, and that's called the declination cycle. So it does, it kind of does this wobble.
That's a significant difference from 28 degrees north to south.
So significant that actually it reaches a maximum about every 19 years in terms of maximum latitude north, maximum south, and it is actually at that maximum right now.
Okay.
This year, and it's called the maximum declination of the moon. And all the stone circles that I've ever looked at, from Stonehenge outwards, all have this pegged. So all the stone circles are aligned to the moon with rocks showing where the maximum declination point is that it goes along the eastern horizon, all viewable from the central circle. So all of these things were weather calculators. It's very important because when the moon is in the north, starting to come down again, it brings, for you, cold weather down from the poles if it's doing that in the winter time. And whenever it does that, it's actually very close to full moon in the winter. And when it's coming up from the south, looking at it from your point of view, it's bringing warmer air up from towards the equator. With us, it's the other way around here in New Zealand. And when it's in the south, that's when we get our snow dumps.
It was based on that you absolutely blew them away on Irish radio, because back in October you'd said to them, it's going to be cold at the end of February, you know, and you were right. How is this guy doing this all the way from New Zealand, telling us what the Irish weather is going to be months in advance?
Well, the moon creates a tide in the air, just like it does in the water and in the land. There is this thing called the land tide, in which the whole land raises up by 8 inches to meet the moon as it comes across, and anybody can find that on Google. Just look up land tide. There's the water tide, of course, everybody knows about that, and it pulls the air as a tide. And anybody who thinks that the air is too puny to be pulled only has to consider this, that in water vapor alone, there is actually 10 times more water in the air, in the atmosphere at any one time, than in all the rivers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The air weighs 5,000 million tons, and so it is, it's actually equivalent to 33 feet of water in weight above your head wherever you stand on the planet. So if that is not a sizable enough thing, both in weight and amount, to be considered a movable tide, then I don't know what is. When the moon pulls the air, it changes the height of the air, just as it changes the height of the water. And that's what we're looking at. We're not looking at pressure. That's where 150 years ago, meteorology took a wrong turning, and they all got hypnotized by this newfangled thing called the barometer, and they couldn't see past that. And really, it was a red herring, because pressure is not what we're talking about in terms of weather. The air is like a gas in an enclosed container, and it's subject to three things: pressure, volume, and temperature, which was called the ideal gas law. We all did that at school. We didn't know what on earth teachers were talking about then, but this is what it was.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the weather, what I'm saying is, when the air height is pulled to a greater sort of height as the moon comes over each day, what it does is it changes the temperature of things, because the air is like a big buffer of for instance, an insulation type material, and it's keeping away two things that want to come down here but can't get past the air. One of them is the heat of the sun, which wants to come down here if it can and burn everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, when the sun's gone away, the cold of space, which also wants to come down here and freeze everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if the air wasn't here, then it would be 180 degrees Fahrenheit down here on Earth instead of about 15 degrees all over the globe. That would be during the daytime, and at night time, when the sun was gone, it would be minus 220 degrees. So it's the air that keeps us alive, because it keeps everything temperate, and it's what keeps these two things away. Now, when the moon comes over, it changes the height of these things, so that if the height of the air pushes away the heat of the sun, then it's not going to get as hot down here. Consequently, if you're in a time when the moon has gone from the sky and it's pulling the height of the air on the other side of the planet, it means that the height of the air where you are is decreased, diminished, lowered, and the heat of the sun can come belting down stronger. Now, that happens on a day of a full moon, because the full moon is the day when the moon rises at sunset. So all during the day, the moon hasn't risen yet, which means that the air height, the height to the top of the atmosphere, is that much lower, which means the sun's heat can come down closer to the ground. And in the summertime, it's the full moon day that is the burn day. Nothing to do with ozone, that's a scam. It's the full moon to the last quarter, and that's the hot time of the summer. It's also the time when tropical cyclones and hurricanes get going. If you want to look up the records for Katrina and Rita, that was the time when they formed, just after full moon. Because what happens is that the sun can come down, beating strongly around the equator where these things form, and it can heat the ocean to a greater degree, because it can get down in a hotter way, because that height of the air isn't there. It needs to heat the ocean to about 28 degrees to grab a whole lot of water all at once and evaporate it, and then this pile of water up in the atmosphere sort of charges around looking for a place to sort of dissipate itself. What that was doing is it's pulling more water up all the time, and when it goes over land, it can't pull up any more water because it's over land, and that's when it drops. So that's the process. But these things only get going around the full moon, most of the time. So, and when they have sometimes Olympic Games events, and like marathons, and they hold them in the summertime over a full moon, people get heat exhaustion. A couple of years ago, a policeman running in the New York Marathon on the day of the full moon, he died from heat exhaustion. So this is what happens in the summertime with the full moon. In the wintertime, it's the time when you get snow. Then the snow falls during the day, and for a slightly different reason, but partly this, it's because the moon is out of the sky, so the colder space comes down lower to the ground and condenses any clouds that are around, and whatever's in the clouds will fall if it's rain or snow. Now, when the moon is out of the sky at night, you're looking at the new moon time, because the new moon is in the sky during the day. And so at night time, the rain or the snow will fall around the new moon. So that's what the air tide does. It changes the time of the day that rain, if it's about, will fall. So you're looking at overnight in a new moon, if the rain's about. If it's a first quarter moon, the rain or snow will occur in the morning up to lunchtime, and if it's a last quarter moon, you'll get this rain in the afternoon, as a rule, not always.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, when you explain it like that, it seems so obvious.
Just before I forget, because you asked me about what happened at the end of February, this other factor of the moon coming closer and further away, called the perigee, that adds to the effect of the air tide.
Yes.
On this. And what happens in the winter time, if it's a new moon and perigee together, is that you get a very much colder night, because the cold of space comes almost down to ground level, because the perigee being around adds to this decrease of air height overnight with the moon out of the sky, it being the new moon time. And you had a new moon and perigee occurring together, both on the same day, on February the 28th. So I was able to say with a lot of confidence, hey, that will be a very, very cold night. Not only that, it was actually the closest perigee for the whole of this year. So this was the month of perigee number one, if you like, with a capital O, and that means that because it varies over the months, this perigee business, and there is one month when it's even closer than all the other months, and that was February. So I was able to say this will probably be the coldest night of the whole year, and you're going to get the snow that will ensue. Now, it's not just me that knows this stuff. For instance, when they did the Apollo moonshot, they went up there 3 days before the perigee. So they knew that they were going to save themselves about 50,000 kilometers worth of fuel, because that's how much the moon varies in distance over the perigee, about 20% closer. They went up in the month that the perigee was the closest for the year, and that's which was July, and that saved them another 10,000 kilometers worth of fuel. So these boys knew exactly what they were doing as to choose a day that was probably the only day that year, within 1 or 2 days, that they could go up and maximize their fuel.
They're just not talking to the weathermen about all this. That's the problem. No wonder you can predict the weather, Ken, because you know how the system works.
Yes, there are these cycles. See, what happens is this. Well, if you averaged all the orbits of the known planets, the big ones, the close to us, our solar system, if you averaged their orbiting behavior, there's actually an average gravitational center of gravity of all of them, and everybody thinks that's the Sun. That point of focus is got a name. Again, it's called the Solar System Barycenter, and it is actually not the Sun all the time, but this point, this imaginary point, really varies across the Sun, and it comes across the Sun again and across the Sun, and it actually goes one Sun's radius on either side of the Sun, and it drifts across the Sun every about 36 years. Well, that's very important, because this beat of 36 years is the beat of solar activity, in which extra solar energy comes from the Sun and comes over us, because we're so close to the Sun. You know, the Sun has this what they call the magnetosphere, or the solar tail, which is a bunch of solar activity that it belts out and goes into space. It actually extends one light year into space out from the Sun. So if you travel at the speed of light for a year, you'll come to the edge of this sort of magnetic influence that comes from the Sun. Well, we're 8 minutes into this solar year, so we're pretty well sort of doused by it. And every time there's extra electrical activity, we feel it here in terms of thunderstorms and stuff on Earth. Now, meteorology doesn't attend at all to any electrostatic or electrical component to weather. All they're talking about is pressure and temperature, and electrical components just don't figure. So they haven't even gone there yet. But they need to one day, because it's part of the whole story. When we look at the Moon and the Earth, okay, the Earth is going around the Sun, and the Moon is sort of going around Earth, except that it's not. Actually, what's happening is the Moon is going around the Sun as well. And, but millions of years ago, the Earth kind of got in the way. Well, people think they formed together. Whatever happened, the Earth grabbed the Moon and wouldn't let it go. So the Moon started doing this wobble to try and get away from the Earth, and even now today it jumps 5 degrees above and below the ecliptic continually, but the Moon is on the ecliptic, same as all the other planets, and they're all going around the Sun. Actually, the Moon is more tied to the Sun than it is to the Earth.
Right.
And we're losing the Moon. We're losing the Moon to the extent of about a centimeter every, I think, 100 years. It's actually moving away from us because it belongs to the Sun. So the Moon is actually focused on the Sun. The Moon is focused on everything the Sun does. And if the Sun has this 36-year beat to it, then the Moon picks up on that. And there's all sorts of cycles depicted in this 36. For example, when Hurricane Katrina and Rita happened, it was widely reported in the papers, especially here, that the last time there was as big a hurricane was 1969, and that was 36 years before. And the time before that, when there was as big a hurricane, was 1933. I think they called it the Chesapeake Bay disaster.
Right.
So this was, you know, big 36-year beats going on. And the Asian tsunami, the last time there was an earthquake of that size in Sumatra was 1968, which was a 36-year gap back from 2004.
That's
so
amazing.
This 36th thing going on. Now, the moon, everything the moon does is some reflection of 36. It's actually not exactly 36. It's, you know, it varies a bit between 36 and 38. So the things to do with the moon are multiples of 18 to 19 years, and there's slight differences. For instance, the tidal cycle, looking at the water tides, that's 18.613 years. There's a cycle of phases that coincide with moonrise times. That's exactly 19 years, and that's got a name. That's called the Metonic cycle, and that's very big in the stone circles. The stone circles all knew, circle builders all knew about the Metonic cycle. Most listeners will be familiar with Stonehenge. I spent 5 years studying Stonehenge, going back, you know, from here every year for 5 years,
right,
surveying the thing.
Mm-hmm.
People will know how big Stonehenge is. Well, it is that size for a reason, and that is that around the outer bank of Stonehenge, which is Stonehenge itself is 378 feet in diameter, around the outer bank, the circumference of the outer bank, 1 week, 1 foot represents 1 week exactly of a giant 19-year circle.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And this was a big weather calculator. All the other stone circles I've looked at are smaller ratios of Stonehenge, such that in Ireland especially, there's a lot that are where 1 foot represents, 3 inches represents 1 week of a giant 19-year circle. Now, and a lot of them have got 19 stones. You'll find that very common. Well, 19 is a very odd number. You know, it's a prime number. It doesn't mean anything anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You can't divide it by anything. You know, 19, why 19? And it has to be 19 because this is this weather calculating sort of facility. So what they would have done around Stonehenge, they would have put these big stone markers or wooden markers around the place, and they would have written on them what the weather was, so that when it came around again, they would have seen, oh yeah, there's a big drought period coming up, or a big rainy period, and they would have sort of acted accordingly, planned accordingly.
Right, right.
And in all the stone circles, they had big ditches around them, big moats. You can still see that in Stonehenge, and quite a few others too, and they did that probably to keep the kids out, you know, and all the drunk people, because they would knock over the markers.
I tell you what, Ken, what you're bringing home to me with your explanation is how dumb we've become. We are so insular in our Western scientific rationalism and so dumb. Maybe you'd cover some other aspects in which modern science may be dumb, and that's in the area of ozone depletion and the Kyoto Protocol. I'm speaking with Ken Ring, and we'll take a quick music break, and we'll be right back, weather permitting, of course.
It's just one more day. No one said there would be rain again. Won't blame it on myself. Yeah, I'll blame it on the weatherman. Get away. Blame it on the weather.
And you're very welcome back. You're on the next level on breakfornews.com. I'm speaking with Ken Ring of predictweather.com. And Ken, you've got some great stuff there on the website in addition to your weather analysis. And that's your analysis of the junk science underlying ozone depletion and the Kyoto Protocol. Maybe we'd start with ozone depletion, because I found your explanation of what's going on there is the most cogent I've ever read.
Well, you know, ozone's one of the biggest scams that ever been put across anybody. There was no ozone scare. I mean, ozone is just ozone is being produced every nanosecond, and it's produced by ultraviolet light coming from the sun hitting warm rising air, and every so often there's a little molecule of O3 produced here, there and everywhere, and it's produced all the time, and it's being destroyed all the time. Mainly it's destroyed by volcanoes, and especially one happens to be down in Antarctica, an active volcano since 1982 called Mount Erebus. Well, that's pumping out 1,000 tons a day of superheated chlorine gas, amongst other nasty things, and it's the chlorine gas that eats ozone.
Mm-hmm.
It's the chlorine gas, of course, that is in the CFCs that are supposed to come from the old fridges. Well, there is chlorine there, but the CFCs are very stable chemicals. You can actually pour them from one bucket to another because they're five times heavier than air is. So they're not going to make it down to Antarctica and up into the atmosphere. Nobody has ever found a CFC yet up above the Antarctica, but they have found superheated chlorine from Mount Erebus. Now, there's no way ozone can stop, for example, skin cancer or something. You know, I go into schools around New Zealand, and the kids are all fed this rubbish that the sun is shining through the Antarctica sky, through the hole in the ozone layer, and onto places like New Zealand and Australia, and forming skin cancer. Well, that is utterly impossible, because the sun is actually to our north, and Antarctica is to our south.
Yes.
And the only way for the sun to shine through the Antarctica skies and hit New Zealand is for Antarctica and Fiji to actually change places, or for the sun to scoot all of a sudden completely underneath the earth.
Yes.
And shine through and onto New Zealand. And no one's ever seen that happen yet.
No.
And if it did, it would make a bigger news story than the ozone thing would.
Oh, they're feeding us a pile of complete rubbish then, Ken.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a form of child abuse. You know, the greenie movement in the world is trying to load it onto the kids. You know, it's not enough of a job that the kids have to grow up. Now they have to grow up, and their job is to save the world, to save the planet. I don't know about your country, but we get all these books coming out aimed at the children. Save the planet. How to save the planet. And what do they tell the kids to do? Turn off the light. And what would that do? Well, turning off the light apparently is going to save power and is going to stop the oceans rising.
So you're saying that we don't need it anyway? And even if we did, we have an inexhaustible supply of it there, because it's an actual process.
They're all focused on skin cancer, and it's supposed to cause skin cancer. But actually, the country in the world that gets the most skin cancer is, the place in the world is actually Darwin, in the very north of Australia, which is as far away from Antarctica, where the ozone hole is, as you can possibly get.
Yes.
It's a half a world away. And the reason why Darwin gets all the skin cancer is the same reason that New Zealand gets a lot of skin cancer, and that's because both of these places are on very thin bits of land. And being thin, they don't retain dust in the atmosphere. And the winds come across and they blow all the dust away, so the skies are very clear. And it's the dust that acts as the filter for the sun's heat, stops people burning so much and, you know, getting so radiated. So where there's a country with a large land mass, they get a lot of dust building up, and they don't get the skin cancer figures.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with ozone.
Yes, exactly. You use a great phrase to illustrate and kick another huge hole in the existing theory by pointing out that bricks don't float up. No, they don't.
You know, out of all the greenhouse gases and all the nasties that they say are floating up, there's actually only two things that do float up, because all the others are heavier than air. For instance, carbon dioxide is nearly twice as heavy as mm-hmm. air. Molecular weight is 44, and air is 29. So the carbon dioxide doesn't float up to form a greenhouse cover. It actually has to be ejected up with great force, and this it does out of volcanoes, mm-hmm. and then it starts to drift down. It's only kept up when it is kept up by upper level turbulence by the winds, but it's coming down all the time, and the plants grab the carbon dioxide, and the plants seize on the carbon molecule. They add water to it, which creates a carbohydrate molecule, which is the building block in nature, and then it flicks out the oxygen. It does that at night, and all of us come along and breathe in the oxygen. Now the plants have their leaves facing upwards, because the carbon dioxide is descending. You can bet your life that the plants are not stupid, and if the carbon dioxide was going up all the time, then they'd turn their leaves over the other way. The fact that they don't must tell you something about carbon dioxide. Now, all the fossil emissions that we're burning and all the stuff that comes out of volcanoes, it all gets mixed together, it all comes down, it all gets gobbled up by the plants. And what do? We come along and we eat the plants. So all of the biofuels that have been burnt by people driving around in cars, you know, where is all that stuff? Well, it is actually in us now. You know, it is in the people.
Yes.
You and I make up what was combusted out of fossil fuels. So there's no harm in that. Now, this is the story of life, and it's the recycling of life. There's no carbon dioxide being added to the planet that wasn't there before, just like there's only a certain amount of water that's in the planet. It doesn't come from outer space, and some of it's going back into space. It's just here. So whatever is here just gets recycled and recycled and recycled. And where's the harm in that? I fly around a lot in aeroplanes
mm-hmm.
because I have to give talks around the place, and I fly at 5 miles up. That is the regulation height.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I always get a window seat because I like to look at the clouds. I've never yet seen a piece of smog come past the window at that height.
Right.
I've never seen a car's exhaust come past the window at that height. I've certainly never seen a cow's fart come past the window at that height.
That's a bit of a shock to my system, realizing that the ozone thing is so flimsy, so completely wrong, so misdirected.
Yeah.
The other great bogeyman, of course, that we're all facing, we're told by Clinton and others, is the global warming problem. But that had its genesis in a very interesting company that people heard of for a brief period back at the start of the Bush presidency, a company called Enron, who are in their own right really responsible for kicking off the whole global warming thing. You have an article about that on the site also.
That's right. The people don't realize that. That without Enron, there would have been no Kyoto Protocol. Enron was over 20 years ago now. It operated natural gas pipelines, and it was buying and selling contracts and bandwidth and all sorts of services, electricity, among other things. And they positioned themselves to a place where they could collect on sulfur dioxide that was being used in factories, which was a pollutant, and the government had brought in a decree that that there would be a taxation factor on that in order to discourage this kind of industrialized waste. So Enron cornered the market on both penalizing running that sort of infrastructure and also supplying more natural products like gas and electricity and more cleaner burning thing. So one day they sat around and thought, well, you know, how can we increase business? What about carbon dioxide? But the problem was carbon dioxide wasn't a pollutant. So they had to make it one in everybody's imagination. And they had Al Gore on their side. Al Gore saw himself, because he was an environmentalist, sitting astride a huge tax-gathering sort of scheme in which the U.S., but in particularly his administration, would gather in a tax from every single factory, because anybody that burns anything puts out carbon dioxide. It's just a result of burning any fuel. So they set about trying to spread this, and they all worked together. Enron was aware that it needed an act of parliament, so they got Clinton and Congress to put through a clause that actually gave Enron some kind of governmental control to do this. Meanwhile, Enron noticed that the Greenies were talking a lot about putting up the prices of fuels, because, you know, if you listen to the Greenies, they want everything to cost more, because they think that if people pay higher prices for electricity and for diesel and for petrol, then they'll use less. Mm-hmm. Well, so Enron started to under the table, purportedly, because, you know, I don't have any more proof of this other than articles that have appeared on the internet about it, and papers that have been presented, and lawsuits that have occurred. But purportedly, they started propping up companies like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and others, and they also helped to create a scaremongering climate in which the Greenies would be the spokespeople who would tell the world about all the pollution that was going on. And Enron would be there to both penalize and to supply alternative fuel systems. So Enron set about grabbing all the wind power companies they could, and they cornered the market there, and they also bought the biggest solar company in the world, and they started to finance everything related to the global warming hype, including grants to scientists, especially ones that, you know, that were working with them. And they were also inaugurating commissions at government level to actually denigrate those scientists who were speaking against them, even
right.
though they actually had their own studies done that found that that there was no problem in global warming, and that there wasn't any human influence going on. They just kept a lid on that. So they even went against their own discoveries from their own internal studies about global warming science. And then, of course, they all got into trouble because they tried to manipulate the electricity prices. They got too greedy, and it suddenly all came down around their ears. But interestingly, President Clinton never, ever lobbied Congress with the Kyoto Protocol. I think he was just a wee bit wiser than that. Now, but you have another thing here going on, and that was evidenced when Bush came over to Scotland and for the G8 conference, telling everybody to look at new technologies to help save the planet, take away the dependence on fossil fuels. You know, well, this was another scam, because from about 2003 to 2005, according to Time, there was an article there called, I think it was The Great Energy Scam, and it was October the 13th, 2003. And what they did was they Congress enacted tax incentives designed to spur the development of a synthetic fuel industry. So what they wanted was to make synthetic fuel competitive with coal. And this was a reasonable idea, that take away your dependence on coal. So the idea was to build huge plants that would transform coal, which the US has 250 years worth, mm-hmm. transform it into synthetic natural gas and oil to heat homes and factories and power cars, and reduce the US dependence on foreign oil. Well, the oil prices fell, but the plant building exercise actually came to nothing. Yet the syn fuel credit still remained on the books. So they had this tax incentive for people to somehow change coal, somehow change oil. But according to the IRS, all you had to do was to change the concept of coal into anything, altering it in any way at all. And this could just include spraying it with diesel, or coating it with latex, mm-hmm. or just adding some other useless chemical. And so then what happened was, you suddenly got these synthetic fuel operations, right next door to coal-burning power plants, and the whole point became not creating a new energy resource, but simply collecting on this giant tax subsidy that was offered. One of them, its name was Progress Energy Inc. in North Carolina. It owned electrical utilities that served homes in Florida, the Carolinas, Carolinas, North and South. In 2004, they filed synthetic fuel production losses of $400 million. But no problem there, because the company claimed $850 million in tax credits, you know, courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer.
Right.
And what they did was they kept oil prices below a certain level. I think it was $50 a barrel, which ensured that these producers could still claim the full value of the credit. And legislation was passed to preserve the oil prices to this level. And this is just, you know, a huge scam. What they're doing, the public coffers in the U.S. receive $1 billion a year or more in taxes and royalties from the burning of oil and gas and coal production in terms of taxes, because they're putting stuff into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And environmentalism has created a climate where all these more emissive industries are taxed more. And then, through clever manipulation of criteria, these big businesses collect via tax breaks. So it's no wonder the corporates are eager to financially support and underwrite Greenpeace and all their greenie sister organizations.
There's a straightforward financial rip-off involved there. Let's turn to some of the substance of the global warming hype, which is, for example, that temperatures are increasing, that we're experiencing the hottest, the warmest ever. Is that correct, or what is the...
You know, they talk about global climate increasing in temperature. Well, I say, hang on, hold the phone there. Global climate, what on earth does that mean? The word climate actually refers to weather at a particular latitude, because mm-hmm. climate comes from the word climb, which means a point on the curvature of the Earth, and that point being a latitude line. So climate is weather at that latitude line. Now, global climate, there's no place. You know, the whole globe is not at the one latitude line. Otherwise, you'd be talking about a flat Earth. And last time I looked or flew over it, you know, it wasn't a flat Earth. There is no such thing as global climate. Well, if there's no such thing as a global climate, then there's nothing that is warming. And what it's become has been a box to throw anything into that's increasing. So all places are having different seasons, and that's because different elevation, different points on the Earth's surface, different configuration of mountains and flatlands, and so every place has its own, if you like, personality, which is its weather. Everybody knows this, everybody accepts this. So there's no one warming factor, because the seasons are all different all the time. So you're getting a situation where some places are warming more than they ever before, some places are cooling, some places are windier, some places are having higher seas for some reason, more floods up the rivers, and some places are drier. And so what global warming has come to be is sort of more of anything. Well, I mean,
They're being very selective in what they report. So every time we get a higher temperature, we report that. Lower ones, we're not interested.
Go and ask a farmer. Don't ask anybody else. Go and ask a farmer if this is the worst since his records began. And, of course, the disservice is that, for instance, here in New Zealand, they had one flood. They called it a once-in-500-year event. But actually, 20 years beforehand, there was another once-in-500-year event. And in the same place, and you know, that was around about the 19-year cycle. Mm-hmm. And so, what people read is that you know, it's not going to happen again in their lifetime, because no one lives 500 years. So they go and build in places that were previously flood-prone valleys, and that's where they come to grief. And all of a sudden, you know, oh, it must be global warming or anything else. Now they're also doing sneaky things. Because what the World Meteorological Organizations have just done is they've reclassified tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
So that tornadoes now click in at something like 76 miles an hour, whereas before they had to be 83 miles an hour to be classed a tornado.
Oh, that's moving the goalpost.
Lesser winds are going to be called tornadoes. And they're going to be able to say there are more tornadoes happening than ever before. But what they've done, really, is they've shifted the goalposts.
So, yeah. David Bellamy has also referred to this when he speaks about, yes, sure, there's glaciers receding here and there, but there's glaciers increasing. Yeah, they don't report those.
Yeah, New Zealand's glaciers have been advancing since 1996. And what they don't point out is that underneath the glaciers, in some places, you have very tectonically active areas, especially New Zealand and especially Iceland, which are very volcanic places, and they just happen to have glaciers on top. So you've got thermal vents down there, which have a cycle to them, cycle of activity, and there's a heating and a receding effect, you know, from that heat. So
They're
not looking at that at all.
But what about the Antarctic? Isn't Antarctica melting?
Not. No, unfortunately, they're not. If you read something like science@nasa.com, there's a whole lot of stuff there about Antarctica that has been growing for the last 20 years. It's actually been getting thicker. You know, this hype of rising seas, you know, is all of a sudden back. The guy who's the director of GISS, G-I-S-S, I don't quite know what that is, but there's a guy called Jim Hansen, and he's NASA has all these different sort of bodies. One part of NASA thinks that global warming is happening, and another part doesn't. But this guy Hansen predicts that as much as 80 feet rise in sea levels is going to happen by 2050. So that's, you know, in less than 50 years, unless we act now. So that's just shy of 2 feet a year, and that's obviously complete bunk, because other experts have said it's going to rise to 200 feet or 2 meters a year, you know. And these people now just get away with making any kind of reckless statement, never mind any science. But if you look around, there are completely different points of view. Greenland, apparently, according to a report of May last year, Greenland has a small overall mass gain corresponding to a lowering of the sea level of 0.03 millimeters a year, minus 0.03 millimeters a year. Antarctica shows a negative net change corresponding to a sea level rise of 0.05 millimeters a year, which means the net effect is close to zero. New flow measurements for the Ross Ice Streams indicate that movement of the ice streams has actually slowed around Antarctica, allowing the ice to thicken. And this is an article in Science of January the 18th of this year. And they realize now it has been slowly thickening for the last 20 years. Now, this is data that can't be denied. But what they do is the scientists have decided Antarctica must be the only continent that is cooling. But yet they can't say why, you know. But
yes.
Now they know that the middle of Greenland is, gaining as well. You know, that's where that gain is. But what they do is they go out there in the summertime and they look and they see the edges breaking off and melting. Down in Antarctica, they can't get out in the wintertime. They're all playing cards in the huts because it gets down to minus 80. You know, nobody can move around in minus 80, so they just don't. Plus, it's pitch dark anyway, so there's no research going on down there in the middle of winter. And when they had to go down there 3 years ago to rescue a doctor who had to operate on herself, it was a big rescue mission. They went down there in the middle of winter. It was minus 75 degrees, and they pulled her out. Minus 75 degrees. So that's what it gets down to. It actually gets down to minus 90. That's the record down there in the middle of winter. So what they're trying to tell you is that Antarctica is going, and of course the Arctic, are going to melt somehow, such that they'll be melted all year round one day, which will raise the sea level by whatever they're saying, 65 meters or 200 feet or whatever. Okay, well, for that to happen, for Antarctica to stay melted all year round, the whole place has to go up in temperature by nearly 90 degrees. Well, 90 degrees happens to be nearly the boiling point of water. So before the seas rise, they're going to just evaporate. And nobody thinks about that.
But there's another reason, Ken, why it can't happen. And it's because of what you've been pointing out, and you allude to this as well in your analysis. It can't happen. It can't heat up that much because the air is thin over the poles.
The whole atmosphere is only about 3 miles high over
right.
the poles, because the sun and the moon are to the side around the level of, you know, the plane of the equator, and the atmosphere goes about 15 to 20 miles out from the equator. So there's a big bulge anyway at the equator. So the cold of space is always going to come just about right down to ground level at the poles, which means there's always going to be a cold bit at the top and the bottom of the Earth and a hot bit in the middle. And that's the way, you know, it's always going to be.
But Ken, nobody explains that to us. You know, nobody says, hey, you know the reason why it's cold at the poles? Because there's very little air above the poles.
Yeah.
That seems to have been, like, dropped out of the curriculum. It is lunacy, then, to talk about the poles melting. They couldn't, not unless the laws of gravity and mass change all of a sudden.
Well,
they
not
can't.
Unless the sun and the moon suddenly shoot up to be above the North Pole or below the South Pole. Actually, the Arctic doesn't get down to the same cold temperature as Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
The Arctic gets down to about minus 55. But minus 50, but you know, if it rises by 55 degrees, 55 degrees is a scalding hot bath. I mean, you know, you wouldn't be able to get into a bath that was 55 degrees. So, you know, that's not going to happen either.
You know, I think what you've helped uncover for me is the reason why the weathermen are turning into like comedy guys on TV, because it's all they can do right. They're using very short-term forecasting.
They can't forecast for a week ahead.
Yes.
Then how can they forecast for 50 years ahead? Talking about extreme weather vis-a-vis global warming. And when I put that question to them, they say, oh, well, we're talking about climate. We're not talking about weather. So I say, what, are they two different things? Oh, yes, they say. So I say, oh, well, how come you're using weather words to talk about climate?
Don't ask awkward questions like that.
They're talking rain and flood and drought and stuff.
Well, listen, Ken, maybe you'd bring us all back down to earth then, because I would listen with great interest to what you think will be the kind of year ahead. You're not using a crystal ball. You're simply using your knowledge of the cycles.
Well, March may also turn colder around the last week. Around about March the 28th, we've got another perigee coming. But I think on April the 13th, winter will suddenly stop, and the clearer weather will arrive, and I think the widespread feeling will be that winter will be over in the middle of April. And following winter, I think spring should be milder in 2006 without the real heat of recent years, and summer heat, I don't think that's going to kick in until later on, probably August and September. They'll be the warmest months of summer. And October also should be mild, and the autumn should turn out to be pleasantly warm. The following winter, the next winter, should be pretty mild. And what you're heading into is milder and milder winters. So in 2 or 3 years' time, you're going to get very mild winters, hardly any snow, and you're also going to get mild summers that are not going to be really hot heat waves and stuff. In other words, the seasons are going to even out more. Mm-hmm. And this is part of a huge cycle of the seasons that takes about 200 years to complete, in which the seasons all move slowly forward incrementally, and they suddenly sort of leap back. So this winter is slightly less cold than it was last winter, and you're coming into milder and milder. You know, it'll be at its mildest in about 2 or 3 years' time. And then, of course, it just winds its way slowly back.
Well, there's another thing going on at the moment, and that's an announcement by NASA that they expect that there is something anomalous going on, unusual going on with the solar pattern, and that the standard 11-year cycle is changing. Does that in any way fit into your knowledge of the lunar and solar movements?
Well, they're starting to notice that there are cycles, you know, mm-hmm. and that at last, hooray, hooray, what took you so long? And NASA has been going around actually also looking at ancient stone circle sites. Mm-hmm. There's a big one here in New Zealand that's on private land. It measures up to Stonehenge. And I went up there to survey it, and the farm manager said, oh, you've just missed the NASA team.
Right.
They were here a month ago, and they were surveying this whole place.
They're seeing the light.
That didn't make the newspapers at all.
Right.
And I think there are people who are aware of this. Now, as far as I'm concerned, as I was saying before, with the sun and the planets and the moon and everything, it's all part of a giant interactive clock. There's not one thing that's happening independent of another.
Yes.
And that's why they can make up a model of a planetarium, because they're all to do with the cogwheels. If you were to join everything up to giant sort of flat wheels with cogs at the end of them, you'll find they all intermesh just like a huge machine.
Yes.
And whatever the sun is doing, the other planets are doing as well. And anybody who poo-poos the old astrology and the fact that the planets have any influence, you know, they've only got to realize this, that it's all part of a giant interactive thing. When you had your hottest summer for 500 years in 2003, it also happened to be the very month that Mars was the closest to Earth for 36,000 years. Now, and then it moved away again, and you stopped having your hot summer. Didn't get a hot summer. Mars was nowhere near close by the time we had our summer following that. But if you read the old Indian Vedic astrology, what their writings are about the weather, it says that Mars, when it comes close, it makes the place having summer turn very dry, very hot, hot pressurized heat. And it's been written there thousands of years ago, you know, and this is just the old way it used to be done and still is done in some of the countries of the world.
It's a fascinating look into what's really going on, Ken. You've ruined it for me now. I think the weather guys should definitely keep up the telling the jokes and maybe even wearing the funny costumes, because they haven't a clue, Ken. And it's great to talk to a weatherman who actually knows what he's talking about. Perhaps we can speak to you again, Ken, but for joining us on The Next Level. Thank you very much indeed.
It's my pleasure.
What an extraordinary guy, and what an incredible weatherman. Ken Ring. There is only one, and there's only one website also. It's predictweather.com. And Ken is a treasure trove of information, I'm sure you'll agree. I'm so glad he could join us for this episode. I'll be back shortly with another guest, and I hope you can join me for that. But in the meantime, for breakfornews.com, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting.
Will you always keep me warm? Home is safe and away from home. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Will you always keep me warm? Home is safe and away from home. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Walking into the sun.